Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Gelton of NPR, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. Diane is on a station visit at WLRN in Miami. For 6 years, Jim and Jamie Dutcher lived among a pack of wolves at the edge of the Sawtooth Mountains in Idaho. During that time, they observed the birth of pups and the death of adult wolves. They saw how wolves mourn, and they came to understand how wolves select their leaders. Their experience living with wolves resulted in 3 documentary films and a brand new book, The Hidden Life of Wolves. Jim and Jamie Dutcher joined me in the studio to discuss their book, The Reintroduction of Wolves to the Northwest, and the wolves' removal from the endangered species list. Jim and Jamie Dutcher, welcome so much to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for having
us. Thanks, Tom. We're thrilled to be here.
This is going to be a fascinating hour, and I'm sure you'll all want to be a part of it. Our number is 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Jim and Jamie, for me and I think virtually every kid in America, what we learned about wolves, we learned from Little Red Riding Hood and the Three Little Pigs. Evil, evil animals. How did wolves get that reputation? And it is so at variance with what you write early in your book. Wolves are curious, caring, and intelligent, sharing strong social bonds. Wolves watch over each other, nurture their injured, and raise their pups among their family groups. How did they get this reputation of being so mean and evil?
Well, I think what happened is we have to remember that wolves and humans have basically evolved together. You can watch wolves and see how early man, Native Americans, really honed their hunting and social skills by watching wolves. And it's thought that wolves and humans, early human hunter-gatherer humans, followed each other, you know, on their hunts and took advantage of each other's skills. That led to the development and domestication of the wolf into the dog, which gave us the ability to domesticate other animals into our livestock. I think what happened is that as humans became more pastoral and more agricultural, they started looking at wolves as competition and a threat rather as a partner. And that really started us down the road. And also with the early development of religion, and that's not knocking religion in any way, but, you know, you have the image of the pastoral flock and the evil devil wolf. And you can imagine in Europe, especially during, you know, the big wars and the black plagues, you know, a lot of people were dying. People were buried in very shallow graves. And wolves, besides being carnivores, are also opportunists. So they would uncover some of these bodies and start feeding. So you've got this image of this vicious animal snarling and growling over a carcass, where, you know, the snarling is and the growling is just a language. But to have that embedded into your mind, you know, really set the stage for the Three Little Pigs and Little Red Riding Hood. And they've been getting a bad rap ever since.
They've been getting a bad rap because what you describe in your book and what I'm sure is shown in your films, Jim Dutcher, is actually, I mean, I used the word pack to describe the social group of wolves that you lived with, but I actually, you seem to prefer the word family. And what you really emphasize in your storytelling here about the life of wolves is that they are a family, very family-oriented animals.
Yeah, right. They're mothers, fathers, aunts and uncles, brothers, sisters, they all hang together. And it's very difficult for another wolf to enter that group. But they do. And wolves disperse from this family. They go off and form other packs. And as dispersers, there could be an alpha, a wannabe alpha that already there's an established alpha in the group. And this bothers me.
You took your headphone out. It's okay. When we get to the callers, you'll put it back on.
Okay. Anyway, so the dispersers go out and they start another pack. And but normally the group of wolves hang together as a family and they care a lot about each other.
Well, one of the things that's so marvelous about your book is that you tell the stories of individual wolves. All of them have names. They have roles. It's really a great family story. And I want to get into that. But first, tell me how you ended up. Give me a little bit of the background of how you ended up living with these wolves.
Well, wolves are very wary animals. They're afraid to. They're afraid of people. And when they see a person observing them, they change their natural behavior. And we wanted to get into the social life of wolves. And so what we did is we formed a pack by bottle feeding puppies from the moment they opened their eyes and we gained their trust. And in this way, we were able to see things that normally you couldn't see in the wild. Another reason for doing it the way we did, back when we started this project, the wolf was an endangered species. And if you were able to, over time, habituate a pack of wolves to your camera and to your presence, well, the next time they saw someone, it may not be a photographer. It'd probably be a hunter. And we would be taking away what those wolves needed more than anything, and that's their fear of humans.
So does that mean that you had reservations about doing what you were doing?
We were cautious about how we went about this because we were going to be living with these wolves. We didn't want them to be perceived as pets, and they weren't. They wouldn't come to us if we wanted them to. Everything was on their terms, and we released them into a very large enclosure.
So, Jamie, you begin by bottle feeding. You just had pups in the beginning. There were no adult wolves there.
Well, in the very beginning of the project, we did have two adult wolves that were given to us from private individuals. And the hope was that they would become the alphas and take in the pups. But it turned out that even though those wolves, those adult wolves, were habituated to people, they were not familiar enough with us. So they were still, you know, very wary and a little uncomfortable. So really the project did start with the pups. One pup, Kamatz, really from the onset showed very alpha qualities and really overshadowed the other adult and took over as alpha. So the two adults were sent back to where they came from, and the original pups were the core of the project.
And to briefly explain the project.
Go ahead.
Well, we lived with these wolves for 6 years. We didn't plan to do that.
You were able to get the Forest Service to
give us
you
a special use,
use
permit, and we leased this land. And over the years, as the project went on, we extended our permit until at the end we couldn't extend it anymore. And so the Nez Perce tribe in northern Idaho came forward, and they were going to be involved in wolf reintroduction. So they took the pack and put them on their land, set up another enclosure similar to ours as a wolf education and research center.
Yeah, and what's important to know is that all behavior studies that have been done on wolves have been done in captivity, and usually in enclosures of 1 to 3 acres, because you just can't see this behavior with spotting scopes. We had the largest enclosure in the world. It was 25 acres. So it really allowed us to really observe these wolves and how they lived their lives. We knew, you know, they couldn't travel long distances or take down large prey in this project, but we were focusing on their social lives.
And we could see this unique relationship that each wolf had with each other. There was the puppy sitter, there were the leaders, there was the scapegoat, there were the clowns.
Right.
Every wolf had a different personality.
That's what's fascinating about your story. Now, do you consider these wolves that you lived with wild wolves, or do you consider them tame wolves?
They're captive wolves. They were captive wolves, and we explain that in all our books and all our films. Mm-hmm. But you really couldn't see this sort of behavior in the wild.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the family aspect and the roles that you saw develop. You were saying, Jamie, that Kamatz, and the names that you gave these wolves came from the Indian language.
Blackfoot
and then
Nez Perce.
That Kamatz emerged very early as a self-confident, assertive wolf that had all these kind of leadership qualities that alpha wolves, the leader wolf in the pack, exhibit or need to exhibit.
Right, right.
Now, how do you explain that? Was that wolf just born that way? Was this a genetic thing? What did you learn about how alpha wolves emerge?
I really think they're born that way. Mm. It's very similar to watching children on a playground. You know, the kids playing. You've got the one child who seems to be organizing the kids and, you know, getting the games together, and then you've got, you know, the omega. The child that, you know, kind of hangs back, is a little bit shy, picked on. It seems to emerge that way. And that's not to say that there isn't competition for that spot. There certainly is. But there seems to be just something that they're born with that starts it off.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I found interesting in your book is that you did not portray the alpha wolf as being necessarily mean or aggressive. In fact, to the contrary, he seems to be very respected by the other wolves, and I don't know if gentle is the right word, but not the meanest wolf in the family by any means.
No, he was a very benevolent leader. And one thing we did notice is that the alphas always were the first to respond to any perceived danger. You hear a sound in the forest, they would stand up and put themselves forward.
And one of the other things that's interesting is that Kamats, the alpha, and Lakota, the omega wolf, were actually, even though they're at opposite ends of the hierarchy, were actually quite close.
Yes, and the omega, the bottom of the pack, he was actually bigger than his brother, the alpha.
Jamie Dutcher that's Jim Dutcher. Jim Dutcher, Jim and Jamie, that's quite a pair of names. Jim is the author of The Hidden Life of Wolves. He's an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. And Jamie Dutcher is the author, co-author of The Hidden Life of Wolves. She worked at the Animal Hospital of Washington, D.C.'s National Zoo. Their new book is The Hidden Life of Wolves. It's a fascinating story. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. And my guests here in the studio are Jim Dutcher and Jamie Dutcher. They are the co-authors of The Hidden Life of Wolves. It's a wonderful book that's based on 6 years of living among wolves in Idaho's Sawtooth Mountains and observing them. They have produced films, and they have this new book. And we were talking just before the break, Jamie, of the family of wolves that you lived with. And family is definitely the right word to describe this group. Let's go through the cast of characters. We've already met Kamats, who is the alpha wolf, the
right.
leader of the pack, and his brother Lakota, mm-hmm. who is the omega wolf. What are some of the other characters that in this wolf family that you lived with?
Well, we have Shamook, who grew to be the alpha female, which was actually quite surprised us. She was a very shy pup. She was always picked upon by the other puppies, and we thought she was definitely destined to be an omega female. But
excuse me,
sure.
So the alpha female, that's Kamats has chosen her to be his mate? Is
yes.
that what you mean? And that makes her the alpha female. So she didn't... She
well,
had
actually,
that thrust
she,
upon her.
She pretty much made that decision.
She did.
We had, at the time, we had two female pups in the pack, and she was very, very shy, where the other one was quite gregarious. And it seemed like a light went off in her head. I better do something about this position. And she just started becoming a little bit more assertive, a little bit more aggressive. And she actually came into estrus first and then really asserted herself and pretty much threw herself at Kamatz. It was quite comical.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, that raises a sensitive point. Actually, I have an email here from Sam, who says, does the alpha male in a wolf pack mate with only the alpha female, or will it also mate with his siblings and daughter? If the latter, how does the pack maintain genetic diversity? Also, please note that the ancient Romans had a favorable opinion of wolves. Well, we'll get back to that later. But how about this issue of meeting and breeding? Because I also saw in your book, you write, on very rare occasions, if conditions are right and there is an abundance of prey, others in the pack will be allowed to breed. Explain what's going on here. How can you, I mean, we don't decide among us who is allowed to breed or not. Everybody, you know, wants to breed. But how does it work in the wolf world?
It's a little complicated. Generally, only the alpha female and male will breed. But if conditions are really right, the alpha male may breed with a beta female or may allow a beta male to breed.
What do you mean allow?
He spends a lot of time keeping the other wolves away from each other. It's a little bit exhausting. And frequently what'll happen with the alpha female is she will make it very uncomfortable for the other females to be able to breed. She'll do a lot of snapping and biting, and they sort of kind of all figure out their place. So it's sort of like where you know, on the plains of Africa where you've got, you know, a male antelope running around crazily stopping the others from breeding.
Interesting.
So, but and actually, if conditions are poor, if there's not a lot of game around, they may not breed in a year. They seem to know that they can't take care of their numbers. They really do take care of their populations.
Jim Dutcher, let's talk a little bit about the social hierarchy here, because you make the point that this fairly rigid hierarchy serves a ecological or evolutionary purpose, or serves some kind of purpose. What is it?
Well, as Jimmy is pointing out, that the wolves won't breed if there's not very much food around. And so having this hierarchy really keeps a balance. If there's lots of prey, they'll go out and they'll be able to bring down other animals and feed on them. But the wolves don't kill for sport. That's one of the new myths. You know, mm-hmm. There's a lot of myths about wolves that they go, they're super size, and the ones that were brought back from Canada and reintroduced are bigger than the wolves that used to live here, and that they kill for sport.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes people find carcasses of elk and deer that haven't been finished. Well, wolves are very shy and elusive animals, and they're easily driven off their prey. And so, but they will go back to that prey and finish it off. It's an important resource for the cold winters.
So the idea of having an alpha wolf and an omega wolf and others in between, it sort of maintains order.
Yes, it's a stabilizing
system. It's organizational. They work together as a family, you know, as a team, you know, to bring down prey. They're not just randomly all scattered around. They really have a system that keeps them working. It's sort of watching a football game.
Okay. So you mentioned before, Jim, before I interrupted you, you mentioned Shamook, who was the alpha female.
Mm-hmm.
And who are some of the other wolves in your family?
We had, of course, Lakota, who was the omega.
Mm-hmm.
And he, interestingly, although he was picked on and forced to eat last, he really was the instigator of play.
Explain why he was.
It seemed to diffuse pack tension. He would be the one to kind of get the other wolves to lighten their mood and sort of play a game of tag. But at the same time, if he really got them riled up, he would be the one that would get picked on. So it was a double-edged sword.
So it's in his interest that there not be tension in the family. Yeah,
exactly. And another important member of the pack is the beta wolf. And in our pack, the wolf was named Motsi.
And explain what the beta wolf is.
The beta wolf seems to be second in command. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean that if something were to happen to the alpha, that wolf would assume the alpha position. But what was really quite interesting in our pack is that the beta wolf really developed quite a friendship with Lakota the Omega. And he would make sure things didn't get too out of hand for the Omega. And what I mean is if the mid-ranking wolves were picking on him, Motsi would actually get into the disagreement and just break things up, change the subject, and Lakota could kind of slink away. And they would also spend time together, you know, separately, which was kind of nice.
Okay, Jim, Jamie just used the word friendship to describe the relationship between these two wolves. Has anyone ever sort of asked you or wondered if you're maybe not anthropomorphizing a little bit? Is that really friendship? Is that really the right kind of word to describe the relationship between these two wild animals?
Well, we're humans and we use human terms. And that's the best term that we can come up with for what they had.
It's accurate in a sense.
Yeah, they were colleagues. In our project, there was another Omega at the very beginning of the project that she also would instigate play, but was picked upon, shunned, not allowed to eat with the rest of the wolves, and would go off by herself and be alone in a remote part of this territory. And on one occasion, a mountain lion got into our project and killed this Omega wolf. Now, what really surprised us about all this is how the rest of the wolves responded to this. They stopped playing. They would play every day, and for some reason they lost the spirit to play. Their howling changed. They used to howl as a group and kind of celebrating their solidarity. They had a lot of excitement in a howl, the yips and whines. After that, they would howl separately and by themselves. And they seemed to really miss this wolf. And when we walked through the area where this incident took place, they were visibly impacted by it. You know, their tails would be down, their ears would be down.
So you mentioned the howling, and it was almost a sign of mourning or distress. Of course, howls have a lot of other functions or a lot of other place in the wolf lives, right?
That's right, yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about howling, because this is, of course, something that is very much also in the popular mythology. We have a recording here that you made of Kamots, the alpha, howling. Let's take a listen.
Jamie did this.
Okay, Jamie. That's really amazing. What is going on there, Jamie?
Well, that was a day when...
That was Kamots. And then he was joined by...
Then he was joined by, actually, Lakota. Mm-hmm. And then I think Motsi comes in there. It was a day that it was particularly quiet, and they had just fed, and they were feeling pretty good. And so they just started up this wonderful howl. And it feels good to hear it again.
So that was, you say, it's a wonderful howl. So we already heard about wolves howling when they're in mourning, but they also howl just when they're feeling good and, you know.
Oh, yeah. They howl for so many reasons. You know, they're feeling good. They're looking out for each other. You know, I'm here. I'm fine. You know, or to see who's out there. You know,
to wait to see who answers.
Yeah,
And do they, obviously, they must be able to recognize each other's howls. They know who they're. They know when they hear a howl, they know whose it is.
I'm sure, because I was able to figure out who was howling, so I'm sure they knew much sooner than I did.
On the cover of the book, there's a wolf called Wahatz, and it means likes to howl. And this wolf, for some reason, always liked to camp out right where our camp was. It was just on the other side of where we were sleeping. And when the other wolves off in the forest would howl back and forth to each other, as Jamie was talking about, sort of saying hello, Wahatz would join them and launch us right out of bed. It was just the tent would actually almost shiver with the sound of his howl. It was beautiful, though, but it was startling.
So I imagine you miss living with these wolves. Do you listen to the howling sounds once in a while just to bring you back, in a sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do miss them. Yeah.
Let's listen to another recording that you made, Jamie. This is, I understand, a group howl. Oh, Okay, there's some sort of whimpering and yelping mixed in there with the howls. What's the? Do you remember the occasion?
Yes, actually, I do. It, you had the adults starting to howl, and then we had the pups, which were the higher howls and whines, kind of coming in and trying to solicit the adult wolves to regurgitate food for them. That's what they do to young pups. But these older pups were kind of like, hey, do you have anything for me? And kind of whining and trying to see if they could get a little something extra, even though they still, you know, were feeding on the carcass.
Okay, Jamie Dutcher is the author, co-author of The Hidden Life of Wolves. I'm Tom Gelton. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. So let's talk about pups, because, again, this is another aspect of the story that really captured my imagination and fascination. You write, Jim and Jamie, you write that wolves, adult wolves, not just take care of their pups, but fawn over them and treat them with great indulgence.
Yes, they do. Wolves love pups, whether they're related to them or not. They nurture them. They take care of them. And the wolf and the pups follow the adult wolves and mimic everything that they're doing. You know, they sniff every flower, and that's how the wolves pass on their knowledge. The little ones follow and watch everything the adults do. And this knowledge is stored with the alphas of the pack. They know where to cross the rivers. They know how to bring down the large moose. And so if you lose the leadership in a pack, then you have a rather dysfunctional pack of wolves.
Jimmy, one of the most poignant stories in your book is when you talk about Shamook giving birth to a litter of pups, and the way the other wolves sort of waited around her den and sort of greeted the birth of the pups with joy, celebration, you said it was.
Yes, it was really an exciting moment for all of us. Weeks before the birth of the pups, Shamook would go off and she was trying to find the right place for her den, and she would dig in a little spot and then move off to another one until she found the right area. Well, this got all the other wolves going as well. They would dig these haphazard dens that were kind of nothing, but they were getting quite excited about it. And then she quietly slipped away, and we noticed that she was gone, and then suddenly all the other wolves were gone. And we went up to where she had dug her den site under a fallen log about 6 feet down into the ground. And all the wolves were standing there very excitedly. And one thing that we didn't write about in the book is that I went down the den to kind of check on the pups and see what was going on. And I had a pretty close relationship with the alpha female, but I kind of felt, well, you know, okay, if I do get bit for doing this, I deserve it.
Yeah.
So she came out of the den, and I was sitting there. She just looked at me, and I thought, well, okay, maybe this is a sign to go in. And I crawled all the way down and just checked on the pups. There were three. And I had a little flashlight, and then I backed out, and she was still sitting there, and she gave me a lick on the nose, and then she went back down. And it was a very exciting moment. But it was interesting because she wouldn't let any other wolf down there.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah, she trusted you more than she did her fellow wolves.
Yeah, I guess so.
and you mentioned, Jim, that wolves care for pups even when they're not their own, and even when they're not from their own family.
That's right.
You introduced some pups into that family, and they were immediately accepted, right?
Yeah, that's how the project started. There was a woman up in Montana who had adopted a pack of wolves. The U.S. Navy was experimenting with them. Experiments were over. They had the sedation drugs that they were using on them, and they were going to euthanize the entire pack. And she had inherited them or took them on. And she had seen a film about mountain lions that I had done and thought I could do some good for wolves. So she contacted us and offered us puppies.
Okay. I'm going to have to read you this email, and I think that you'll understand why I'm reading it. This is from Marie, and she says, "These are nice stories being shared about nice wolf families. University researchers have proof that when wolves kill cattle, for example, they start eating them while their hearts are still beating. Wolves in new areas cause some problems." So We have some listeners that, you know, aren't entirely comfortable with this portrayal of wolves as being cuddly little creatures.
Well, you know, wolves are carnivores. They have to kill to sustain themselves. And unfortunately, all they have are their, you know, their speed, their brains, and their teeth. They can't kill as gracefully as a bear or a lion. So, yes, they do feed on animals while they're still alive. But that's part of nature. I mean, it happens on the African plains all the time. And, you know, livestock, you know, that is a real issue. It's something that we deal with all the time. Livestock losses have turned out to be far less than anyone has ever predicted. Less than 2% of all livestock predation is attributed to wolves.
Jamie Dutcher is co-author of The Hidden Life of Wolves. And when we come back after this short break, we are going to be talking about some of these practical issues and why wolves were on the endangered species and list and are no more. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Bradley Cooper talks about his Oscar-nominated performance in Silver Linings Playbook and lots of other things, including the really dark adult movies he grew up watching with his father, why he wanted to be a soldier when he was young, how he sometimes cries like a hyena, and why he hates it when photographers ask him to do those sexy man poses. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in today for Diane Rehm, and we're talking about The Hidden Life of Wolves. That's the title of a brand new book by Jim and Jamie Dutcher, who actually lived with a family of wolves in Idaho back in beginning in 1996. And we have a ton of emails and listeners anxious to comment on them, so let's jump right in. We have, first of all, a couple of emailers from Michigan who are worried about a new law that will allow wolf hunting, a wolf hunt in Michigan. Do you know the background of this?
I don't know all of the details on that, but I do know that, you know, since the western states have been hunting wolves, that Michigan and some of the other Great Lakes states have been pushing for it. What's interesting is that I think I'm correct in saying this. They have not had any problems mm-hmm. with predation on livestock. And in fact, their deer population is still quite out of control. So even though that area has a pretty substantial population of wolves, I think, you know, around the 3,000 numbers, they're not really affecting anything. And I think by hunting these wolves, they're going to start having other problems. Because as we've talked about how the alphas really carry the knowledge and stand up to perceived dangers, if you've got hunters and they have the opportunity to take perhaps the larger, bigger alpha wolves, you're then left with maybe some young kids that don't really know how to take care of themselves, and that's when they'll start getting into trouble.
Now, of course, as we said at the beginning, there was a time when there are virtually no wolves in the lower 48. Is there a danger that taking wolves off the endangered species list will return us to that situation?
No. Wolves regulate their own populations. We've had about 174 wolves in Yellowstone, and that population crashed with diseases and such down to in the 90s. So they won't overpopulate. I mean, elk and deer and wolves have lived together for decades and decades. And
no, but
they
I'm wondering
themselves.
The opposite. If you allow hunting of wolves, if you take wolves off the endangered species list, is there a danger that once again the population
will
be?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And that's happening now. Wolves are off the endangered species mm-hmm. list. And just in the last 17 months when wolf hunting season started in the three western states, the population has gone from 1,700 wolves, which is not a lot, to less than 1,000. So it's decimating the wolf populations. In fact, in Idaho, just before we left, there's a proposal to allow trappers to use the carcasses of wolves and dead pups to bait their traps, which then uses what wolves really have against them, their family caring, their family bond, to kill more wolves. Montana, this has just happened in the legislature, is proposing using silencers to shoot wolves, and also not allow for a buffer zone outside the national park. It's really become, it's not hunting, it's an absolute slaughter.
Okay, let's go now to Alicia, who's calling us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to share with you a wonderful moment that I spent with a wolf. I'm a professional photographer, and another photographer from another town came to take some pictures of some wolves. They had arranged for this meeting, and we were at a lake. It was early in the morning, foggy, and I was really scared, so I kept my distance from the wolves. And there was one that was 6 months old, a white wolf, beautiful. Her name was Angel. And she approached me when evidently she saw that I was respected her territory and started playing with me. 6 months later, that photographer came back to town, and we went to the place where the wolves were, and the wolf recognized me.
That's amazing. You know, and one of the things, what strikes me about Alicia's comment is that she was a stranger, and you said before that wolves instinctively fear humans, but yeah.
But
on the other
there's
hand,
a curiosity.
That there is a curiosity.
They are curious.
Somebody writes from Twitter, there's no name here, I was curious if your guests have ever had a hostile encounter with wolves in your study.
No. We've never had, and there's never been a hostile encounter with wolves since wolves have been reintroduced. There's not one incident in the areas of Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana. And over the past 100 years, there's only two cases where a wolf reportedly killed a human being in North America. And when you can contrast that with bears, both grizzlies and black bears, they've killed 35 people in the last 12 years.
Let's go now to Nancy, who's on the line from Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Nancy. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Back in 1999, I took myself out to northern Arizona to work with some people I had heard about who were calling themselves wolf rescuers, and they had there were three different people who had wolves, and I ended up working with a man who I do believe his heart was in the right place, but I have two questions based on my experience. As I continued to work with him, and the wolves, I just want to interject, were the most wonderful creatures, and indeed, even though I was a stranger to them, they were so friendly and curious toward me all the time, and it was the most wonderful experience. But as I continued to work with them, I became concerned that maybe just having one's heart in the right place wasn't enough, and that these wolves were not being taken care of optimally. And what I saw, and this is my question for you, is one day I went up and pups had been born over the previous couple of weeks, and I drove up and there was a very young little teeny tiny pup, just days old, and its mother was cleaning it. And then it started crying and crying more loudly and loudly, and I was concerned. And I actually witnessed, to my horror, this female wolf can eat her pup. And when I got to the house of the man who ran this sanctuary, and I told him, he kind of just shrugged his shoulders and said, well, they do that sometimes. And to me, I just thought, this is a bad, bad sign. I don't know what of. I was very ignorant of the whole thing, but I just thought, you know, they don't have enough room, or they're afraid they don't have enough food or something. So I want to know if indeed that was a very bad, or at least a bad sign that they were not being taken care of optimally. And secondly, kind of going into my second question, I used to ask, well, where did these wolves come from? And he would just kind of romantically say, well, I went up to Canada. They're Canadian tundra wolves. I went up to Canada and got them, you know, whatever, 7-8 years ago. And I never understood exactly how a regular citizen, he was very uneducated, mm-hmm. again, very nice man, but how he came to have them. Those are my questions.
Right. How so you're suspecting, Nancy, that those wolves, that there might have been something amiss in their lives.
In their care. Yeah.
Okay.
Even though he meant well.
Yeah, let's put that to Jamie.
Yeah. Without seeing and knowing the situation, I can't exactly speak to what was going on there, what kind of setup it was. I do know that there are, you know, a lot of good hearted people that like to have captive wolves, and they allow them to breed, and they really don't have the room for them. And really, you know, wolves are meant to be wild. You know, we shouldn't have them as pets. We shouldn't keep them in small enclosures. You know, we were doing a social study. We had the largest enclosure in the world.
But you kept your distance from them.
And the wolves would come to us if they chose to. We wouldn't go to them. So, you know, I can't speak to your exact situation. As far as the female eating the pup, I don't know. But a lot of animals in the wild, if there's something wrong with a newborn pup, kitten, whatever, they will get rid of it. And there have been reports in other species where, you know, they'll get consumed. So, you know, so I can't exactly speak to that, but I do feel for your concern.
On the other hand, you have another interesting story in your book of a wolf who was injured. I think a moose kicked him in the jaw,
yes,
or something,
yeah,
like that, and
right.
He wasn't able to eat. I guess it wasn't one of your wolves, but you heard about it. And the other wolves actually did not reject him, but sort of tried to help him, take care of him, and even feed him. Huh?
Right. We were up in Alaska filming, and a fish and wildlife biologist showed us the skull of an average size age wolf, and it had a broken jawbone. And yet the wolf lived on for years and years, and that jawbone healed. And and this could only have happened if the pack brought food to it. You know, this wolf injured like that couldn't pull
right.
food off a carcass, couldn't make a kill. And it probably was fed by the other members of the pack regurgitating food.
That's an amazing story. We have some listeners that want to talk about literature and the importance of wolves in literature, and that's something we mentioned at the beginning of the show. Ruth writes, please comment on the accuracy or plausibility of the wolf's behavior in Julie of the Wolves, The Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling, the Disney Jungle Book movie. Are there real-life examples of wolves taking care of humans, children, or adults? Also, I think we've had a number of listeners wanting to know your thoughts on the accuracy of Never Cry Wolf, the book by Farley Mowat, and the movie based on the book. Do you have any comments on the accuracy of some of these wolf stories that have been popularized in these books?
Well, as far as you know, wolves taking in children.
Yeah.
Besides Romulus and Remus, I don't really know of any recently. But, you know, wolves are incredibly caring animals. So I certainly wouldn't say never about that. As far as Julie and the Wolves, it's been quite a long time since I've read that book, so I can't quite
I can't
remember that one. but Farley Mowat's book, Never Cry Wolf, it's an excellent, excellent book, and it was an excellent film. I love it. I know that he was criticized because people thought that, you know, he made some things up. And I have to tell you, reading that book actually very carefully, if he made things up, he did a really great job.
And it sounded right to you.
It sounded right. I mean, he observed things that we have observed. We know other people have observed. So I really feel he got that right.
Jamie Dutcher is co-author of The Hidden Life of Wolves. I'm Tom Gelton. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I do want to read one more email from someone who's concerned about livestock. Wolves are beautiful. This is Louise wrote this. Wolves are beautiful, intelligent animals, but the reality is they do threaten the livelihoods of Western ranch families that keep cattle and other herd animals. Putting limitations on wolf ranges are legitimate. For example, wolves that were introduced to Yellowstone National Park can be found threatening herds as far away as South Dakota, attacking calves, leaving them to die, and frightening herds. This came up earlier. Do you have any thoughts on this?
There are about 5 million cattle on the open range in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. And last year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said wolves were responsible for 180 of them. That's like one out of every 33,000. It really isn't that such a big problem. With sheep, National Geographic figures from the USDA, 31,000 sheep were killed by coyotes, and wolves killed 1,300. Okay. It's quite blown out of proportion.
Okay. Elaine is on the line now from Middleburg, Virginia. I know you've been waiting a long time, Elaine. Thank
you so much. This is the most important program that I've heard in a long time. I have in front of me the beautiful pictorial book, The Sawtooth Wolves, which I think came out a few years ago. And I always wondered what happened to that group of wolves. But also, what I would hope you would be talking about, how the wolves were removed from the Endangered Species Act, not by any scientific reason, but by a very sneaky rider, and the whole thing was political. And ever since then, they have been under attack. You mentioned the Michigan wolves. The governor has signed the law now. I think there's a petition against it for bounty hunters. Wyoming, it's trapping gas. It's appalling. And there has been complete silence on all sides about it. So I'm very happy that this program has come on, and I hope it gets a lot of publicity. My question is, there's a new minister of the Interior, a woman called Sandra Jewell, who is going to replace Wilsack. Do you think there's any hope that the federal government will be able to do something, because the fish and game certainly are not, and they're in the hands of the ranchers and the hunters?
Well, Jim, to what extent is federal policy relevant here? I mean, we've heard a couple of examples of state laws being passed, and this one in Michigan, Kelly, who I'm not going to get a chance to get to, is also, she's coming from Michigan, she's very concerned about that law as well in Michigan. Is there any role here for the federal government?
Yes, there is. And this all happened about a year and a half ago, as Elaine said. Wolves were taken off the endangered species list in a budget bill. It was buried as a rider. There was no discussion about wolves. Both houses had to vote for the budget, and it passed. And what happened is the management of wolves was turned over to the states, and they opened up a hunting season. And as Jamie pointed out, out of the 1,700 wolves we had about 17 months ago, we've lost about 1,000. This is not about hunting and killing animals for their fur, or putting trophies on the wall. A hunter can kill as many as 16. This is about getting rid of the species. And it's really sad. And this does not reflect the average American. Americans really wanted to see wolves come back. And the citizens of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, really the majority don't feel this way either. But it's a very hostile group of people that are hunting with hate and anger.
Margie, who's on the line from Zionsville, I'm not going to get a chance to get to you, Margie, but she asks, Jamie, what can average citizens do to help stop wolf hunts especially since they've been removed from the endangered species list?
I think people just need to be incredibly vocal and much, much more aware. Since management has been turned over to the states rather than the federal government, it's really out of the national press, and we really have to be loud. I highly recommend you can go to our website, livingwithwolves.org. We have a nonprofit, and there you can find a list of your state representatives and write, call, email, be angry. Be very angry.
And I should point out that you can see a slideshow of Jim and Jamie's photos on our website, as well as a video of the Dutcher's time with the sawtooth pack in Idaho. And before we go, I want to point out that we got several emails and tweets from people who say that when we played the wolf howls, their dogs started howling along. I'm sure that that doesn't come as a surprise to you. My guests today have been Jim Dutcher and Jamie Dutcher. They are the authors of a wonderful new book, The Hidden Life of Wolves, and also of films and videos about their time with the wolf family in the Sawtooth Mountains of Idaho. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Tom.
The Green Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, and Lisa Dunn. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yorvlifker answers the phones.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and